People like from the Bay Area who drive into the San Joaquin Valley, and they put Radio Bilingue on Sundays for their children to listen to and say, folks, this is real Mexican Chicano radio. This is indigenous people radio.
That's the founder and executive director of Radio Bilingue and the 2020 Best Lomax Hawes National Heritage Fellow, Hugo Morales. And this is Artworks, the weekly podcast produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Hugo Morales has an extraordinary story. He's a Mixtec, born in Oaxaca. He emigrated to the United States at the age of 9 and joined his father in the fields of California harvesting fruit. It was a life of poverty, but it was a life filled with tradition and music, because his father played the violin and guitar with other indigenous people. And Hugo discovered early on how music gave both strength and solace to individual people and to the community as a whole. Hugo Morales ended up at Harvard and then Harvard Law, but he returned each summer to work in the fields. And when he graduated, he came back to Central California for good. His aim was to work for his people, the Mixteca and farm workers. He chose to do that through radio, and Radio Bilingue was born. It's the first Latino-controlled, full-power FM radio station in the Central Valley. Now, 30 years later, Radio Bilingue is the leading Latino public radio network and content producer for the nation's public broadcasting system, with 24 stations and over 74 affiliates. Based on honest culture, by and for the people, Radio Bilingue has become the trusted voice of the community, broadcasting the diverse voices, music, and culture of farm workers. Hugo Morales has led Radio Bilingue since its inception, and he has won many, many awards, including a MacArthur Fellowship, the Edward R. Murrow Award, and now he's been named a National Heritage Fellow. But that's enough from me. Now, let's hear from Hugo Morales.
I was born in Oaxaca. I'm a Mixtec from the Mixteco tribe. So I was born in Cuyotepeji, Huajuapan de Leon, Oaxaca, which is a remote village at 8,000 feet. And our tribe is about 3 million people. We have our own language, our own culture, our own music, our own food, and our own history. And so I grew up only knowing my own people until the age of 9. In other words, I thought the world was only made of Mixtecos, because like myself, like my parents, I did not know my father until I was 9. He left. He was an undocumented worker who had left the family and came to the U.S., to California, to look for economic opportunities. So when he legalized in 1957, the next year, he was able to bring the family legally and became part of the farm labor force in California in 1968 at the age of 9. So I grew up in a farm labor camp. It was a very beautiful place in a lot of ways, fertile lands, lots of water, and so forth, compared to the desert that I had been grown up in. And I met my father, who was a musician. You know, he played the guitar, he played the violin, he was a violinist. And he also practiced music with other indigenous people. And so they would come weekly to practice with my father. My father was the leader, and he's the one that used to pass on musical technique to the other folks who were also farm workers working in the apple fields. So I grew up among these artists and picked prunes and other crops. So we're literally an impoverished community. The people that I came in contact with mostly were other children during the summer who were poor whites, poor blacks, poor Mexican-Americans from Texas, migrant stream, and also poor Mexican-American children from the Central Valley. So that's how it was. So it was a kind of very isolated community within the mainstream English-speaking Anglo-white community there in Sonoma County. And so we had our own culture as indigenous people and as Mexican people, as farm workers.
And there was isolation, but there was also the foundation of traditional music that was so important, as you said, to you, to your family, to your community.
That's right. And that's something that was very important to me, became very important to me. And it was very important, particularly to my father. Maybe it was same to my mom, but she wouldn't articulate it. But my father lost no time in consistently at a dinner table telling us about the pride we should have and the culture we had and being indigenous, having a rich history, a rich culture, wonderful traditions. And he also talked about how he learned a lot coming to the U.S., that he had learned some wonderful traditions in the United States that he thought we should adopt because they were good traditions. But he also said that we should be proud of being who we are, because considering there's a lot of prejudice for those of us that stand out and stand up to identify to be different. And he said we should always be proud of who we are. And it's not just in the U.S., so the truth in Mexico, where we as indigenous people are singled out also for discrimination.
You mentioned it was an isolated existence, and then you developed tuberculosis. And even though you had to be literally physically isolated, in a kind of ironic way, that opened the world up for you.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, I was a child and obviously I was under the family unit, so I had no idea of the outside world. To me, the outside world was the mainstream. And so when I was 12, I got diagnosed with tuberculosis and I was, you know, literally put in isolation in a locked room, 12 by 12, no bathroom, no shower, no radio, no TV. So I really had a lot of opportunity to read. So that's what I did. So being in isolation, I really got an appreciation for the mainstream. I didn't realize that there was no such thing as a mainstream. So I learned a lot of what I could as a 12-year-old of what the mainstream was about through periodicals and books. And I also began to see the perspective of how the mainstream looked at other people, like African Americans, Native Americans, immigrants. And so I began to get a view of the landscape, the socioeconomic landscape in this country and the world. For me, it was very educational. And in Spanish, it would say nutritivo, which means it was a real opportunity to harvest a lot of information and digest that and process it and come out of there with something positive. My father was always a positive man. Luckily, I hope I inherited some of that.
Oh, I think you did. Now, how did you become first involved in radio?
Well, by the time I was 14, my brother, he had just graduated from high school, and he did a radio show on a commercial country western station, KVRE in Santa Rosa. So I used to go and help him with his coffee and give his coffee. They tear the teletype, UPI, and then also...
oh, my God.
And also help him with his records. But I was not allowed on the board. But what it exposed me to was the power of radio, because even though it was a small population of Mexicans where the signal reached, which was Sonoma, Napa counties, everybody, all the families listened to his radio shows on Sundays. And that's where I learned the power of radio.
Your life took you to Harvard as an undergraduate. What was that experience like? It's just so different in every way, not just culturally, but geographically so different.
Yeah, well, you know, what happened during the years at the sanitarium, I realized that I really needed to get an education. My mom always wanted me to get an education. But I thought that what I should do is go to a school where I could be a leader, at least in my simplistic head. And so I wanted to go to an Ivy League school. So I was accepted to Harvard, also to Stanford and Berkeley. And so I went to Harvard College, and I became the only Mexican-American there in my class. So that was very strange, because I didn't realize there were some things that actually were very close to me that I had no idea that I would miss. Basically, is my family, which everybody misses their family, but the food, my God. I always had tortillas and beans every day. And all of a sudden, there's no tortillas and there's no beans and hot peppers. So that, you know, that was my basic diet. And so it was very, very traumatic in that sense, that the cultural part was very traumatic. But I met some wonderful classmates, particularly from Michigan, who were incredibly generous and welcoming.
And you also worked on the radio there, didn't you, at Harvard?
Yeah, by the time I was a junior, 70, 71. There were now several Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans at the Harvard School of Education. So there was an effort by the students to have the radio station serve the local Latino population. And I joined that effort, and Harvard College had, and probably still does, have a rule that only undergrads can staff that radio station. And so I was one of the few Latinos that actually qualified. And so I became a programmer there at WHRB, which reaches the whole Boston area. So I was the one who introduced Latino voices to Boston coming from a campus. I may be the first person to have introduced campus radio with a Latino format in the U.S. I don't know. I'd have to check that. But definitely in the Ivy League along the Eastern Seaboard, I was the one in 1970. And what I did is, instead of me just having my own show like all the other undergrads, I invited people from the community to come and do the show. So I had Puerto Rican young people from the School of Education do the radio show on Saturday nights for an hour. And then on Sunday, the 1 hour became a show produced by Mexican-American from Texas who had settled in the Boston area. So those were the folks who actually did the show, and I did the mixing. So that's how I learned again the power of radio and the importance of giving voices to the community. I felt very privileged to be a Harvard student. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be good to open this airwaves to the community? And that's what I did. And I was the only undergrad who did that, by the way.
And you went on to Harvard Law School.
Correct.
You kept going back to the Central Valley. You kept going back to California and working in the fields during the summer, when you obviously had the option to do other things as well. Tell me what your thinking was about making that choice.
Well, you know, a lot of it goes through being indigenous. Being indigenous in our community, when people leave, you know, our community to go to school, whatever, to look for a better life economically, a lot of people don't come back. So there's this cultural value in our village in Oaxaca to somehow not do that, that we should be proud of our own village, our own people, our own customs. So that was part of it. But the other is that when I got to Harvard, I realized that what a rare experience I was going through. I never met another indigenous person at Harvard College when I was there. I knew that another indigenous person had been accepted because he was featured in the Harvard Crimson, the school newspaper, the first week of school, but I never got to see the gentleman. So not until I got to Harvard Law did I meet another indigenous person who was from American tribe there in the U.S. Also, what happened is at Harvard College, I realized that even literature about poor people and poverty was very, very rare. And so I will often be asked by my own classmates to tell them about the experience of being a farm worker, because they were really sincerely, this is, again, the generation of change, class of 72, 68 or 72, you know, a lot of interest by the mainstream youth to want to change the world. So they wanted to know about, you know, what it was being a farm worker and so on. But also, like, sometimes graduate students in the School of Design would have me come over and talk to their group about how they would build sanitary, comfortable, useful, warm housing for farm workers. So I would go, and so they would have me tell, like, about my life and about how we live, our customs and all that, so they could build housing that was friendly to that lifestyle. So anyway, I realized what an incredible opportunity I had, but also what a valuable opportunity I had, in that here I was, going to Harvard College, Harvard Law, I could be a resource to help the people I wanted to help, which is the farm workers. I still identified as a farm worker. So I figured, as long as I could be among my people, farm workers, my own family, indigenous family, and go to the dances, go to the socials and work in the fields and get on my knees and put those prunes on the bucket, that was a good thing. It's something that was unique, was an opportunity. And then I also, I thought there'd be an experience that maybe some of my fellow undergrads would, I would say, benefit from that experience. And so about five or six of my classmates did come to live in the farm fields with us in the labor camp and work in the fields. They took that much interest in wanting to help farm workers. So that's why I went back. In a way, also, I wanted to be able to narrate and speak for that community. And that at some point I had to leave that community, but as long as I could be there and experience it, I would be better able to articulate that experience in a positive way. And so I really enjoyed and benefited from all those years being an Ivy Leaguer and also living and working in the fields.
When you graduated and you went back to California, was radio on your mind? Did you know that you really did want to use that great power of broadcasting to have an effect on people's lives and hear about their lives?
Yes, exactly. And you have it right. I want to hear about their life. I wanted them to tell their own stories. And so that's what I did. I really, really wanted to go to Fresno and help my fellow farm workers there. And so that's what I did. So, and I looked at Fresno because it's the center of agribusiness in the United States. And the San Joaquin Valley has the largest concentration of farm workers in the United States. And I wanted to have an impact. For whatever reason, I felt that I had leadership potential. I had something to contribute. I'd spent 7 years at Harvard, and I figured, you know, and this is something that not just, you know, Cesar Chavez would tell us as youth, but also my own parents. They said, you know, you should go to school, come back and help us. So that was the whole idea of doing that. And also, again, those voices to have the farm workers help each other, share information, showcase the wealth of our music and music genres in the plural, and have a good time and enjoy that music, those traditions, but also be empowered by information that would help our own families uplift ourselves and make our life healthier, but also more economically viable.
Before we talk about origin of Radio Bilingüe, I'm curious about what the radio landscape was for Spanish-speaking people in California at the time. Were there Spanish language radio stations? What was going on public radio? What was the landscape?
Well, the landscape was like in 1976, when I started Radio Bilingüe here in Fresno, there was two AM radio stations that broadcast in Fresno. That was it. And only during daytime. And both of them were not owned by Latinos. And that was very, very typical. San Francisco did not have a Spanish language station. The only Bay Area service was one, KLOK, out of San Jose. That served the whole Bay Area. And that station could only be heard right around San Jose during the day. And then during the night, its signal would go throughout the whole Bay Area. So I grew up listening to that station when we would wake up at 4 in the morning to go to the fields. So in other words, it was very, very sparse. All those stations were not owned by Latinos. And then my experience at Harvard really helped in terms of the radio because it was student run. And every semester we had to elect our own officers at the radio station. We're all volunteer students, undergrads. And it was always became a political alignment there at Harvard. It was essentially the news department of students and classical versus jazz and folk and alternative. So every semester I had to justify La Hora, the Latino hour, to this board of directors who were other undergrads. And with these kids, didn't even know a thing about what I was doing, right? So I figured that that's the same thing what happens in the adult world, is that often those people who own the airwaves have no sense or interest, frankly, in what is going over the airwaves if they're not connected somehow with the content. And so when I graduated, I wanted to see and became a militant for Latino-owned media. And I chose radio because I figured that it could be cheap, at least less expensive than television, and accessible, which would lend itself to independence. Independence for me and for us, the founder, was so critical for us to be able to guide the format and the narrative over the airwaves.
What you said at one point, that you founded Radio Bilingüe on the principle of honest culture by and for the people. And I love that concept of honest culture. And I'd like you to just talk a bit about what you mean by it.
Well, what I mean is that it's authentic. You know, we're not hiding anything. We're broadcasting to our own people, and they know what's authentic and what's not. And also that it's a forum where people can call and feel comfortable and feel welcome. For example, right now we have a radio show, highly listened to radio show on Sundays, that features indigenous Mixteco and other indigenous music from southern Mexico, mostly Oaxaca, Guerrero, and Veracruz, and Puebla. And so this music is the real thing, and it's authentic. It's honest. You know, we are very, very honest of who we are. We're very honest about our people. We treasure and highlight those treasures among our own tribe and in our own sectors. We also accept the voices. You know, I mean, we have, for example, our Poet Laureate come on Linea Abierta National Talk Show, and he has invited people to the longest poem in the U.S.,
And you're talking about U.S. Poet Laureate from 2015 to 2017, Juan Felipe Herrera.
Correct. So here we are on Radio Bilingüe, and people are calling in, farm workers or teachers or doctors, calling in and reciting their own verses. You know, so that becomes the poem. It's those kind of voices that is so important. And also, we feature not just indigenous music, but Tejano. And with down-home Tejano music, you know, conjunto, and the music that's been the tradition of the border, Veracruz, mariachi, and other genres. And so that's what the authenticity is the voices and the music of the people.
Hugo, I know independent radio and starting a radio station is not easy. How did you work to make this happen? Tell me about that.
You know, that's very, very interesting. You know, well, I didn't realize how bold I was when I was 13, when I came out of the hospital, and I set sights on doing something meaningful. And I think that blind energy, shall we say, boldness, like wanted to go to Stanford, I wanted to go to Harvard, or go to college, period. That's pretty bold. And I didn't realize how difficult it was to get in. You know, I didn't look at the statistics. But I think it's that boldness, so that when I graduated Harvard Law, I figured, well, God, I could do anything. And so what I did is, with no money, I just read up on what could be done to build a station, and that's how I did it. And then, you know, I had a lot of faith in the local community here. I heard through the grapevine there was a high school student, a 15-year-old, who said he could build a station, but nobody would believe him. So I went to his high school and said, hey, you'll have to build a station? He said, yeah, let's do it. So his father was the chief engineer for the local ABC affiliate. And so he's the one that actually did it. And then on fundraising, you know, I still had my parents were organizers. So I come from a long line of community organizers. And they had organized dances and so on. My father had a band. And so they raised money and for scholarships and funeral fund. So I thought I would do that because I wanted to have independent airwaves. I did not want to depend on corporations for funding, thinking that money would corrupt. So what happened is this other farm worker I told you went to Harvard with came back to Fresno. So I told him I needed help. He says, well, you know, what you really need help is in fundraising. He says, you can't raise money on menudo breakfast like you are and all these small dances. You really need to go to foundations. And that's where the whole building a different, literally a different paradigm for independent Latino radio began. And essentially, many parts did not come from me, but from people who chose to help me.
Now, is the station, or was the station then, staffed by volunteers? Did you find volunteers from the community to come in and, you know, run the board, have shows? How do you work out the staffing?
Yeah, so we began broadcasting July 4th, 1980, and we chose July 4th, 1980, again, First Amendment and independence and being American. And so what we did, just like you said, we began with volunteers. I really believe in volunteers, in voices and so on. So that's how we did. But we also learned about the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. They insisted on 5 people being paid. And so what we did is we got some CETA money, job training program money, and that's how we began with a small grant for 5 people to get training in radio, including myself. So we all got minimum wage jobs, and that's how we began. And we trained over 1,000 people. You know, these were farm workers, there was janitors, these were, you know, packing house workers, lawyers, teachers, trained all these folks in radio. In the 80s, it was an incredible experience to be part of that and be the leader of that. It was the voices. In other words, we took the voices of the local people. And it was also interesting, there was all young people. Nobody was older than me. We were all, we went on the air, we were about 30 years old, and they were all 30 and younger, and we're all under 5'6".
You know, you grew this into a network, which is extraordinary. All of you did. I mean, I understand it's a group effort, but is it a bit challenging when suddenly it's 24 radio stations as opposed to one for everybody to have the same mission and have the same goal?
Well, one of the things that keeps us grounded is the fact that it's live interactive. You know, when I came to Fresno, Fresno's like most cities in the world and in the United States are segregated. There's neighborhoods that are for poor people and neighborhoods that are for the well-to-do. So I chose to live among the poor people. So that was very important to me, to be able to live among, continue to live among poor people, earn minimum wage. And so I wouldn't lose that perspective and to build a culture, including within myself, that this was not my radio station. This is a community station, which is very much the indigenous tradition. You know, we in our indigenous villages have a tradition of tekyo, which is essentially a volunteer system. And that's how we have kept our communities alive and functioning with volunteer mayors, volunteer secretaries, volunteer, you know, school committee, whatever, all volunteers. So that's, I grew with that culture. And so we've had a really good luck about having board members and staff that believe in that mission. And so we've had incredible opportunities to do that. And we're tested from time to time, you know, like right now in the pandemic. Again, it shows the value of community radio and authentic Latino voices being a trusted messenger. We cannot be trusted if the voices that are on the air are not trusted voices. And they're trusted voices because they come from the community. People identify with them. It's not just their voice, but the way they speak, also their cultural references, their lifestyle, all that is from the community. And so that makes it a very powerful platform for engagement. And the music. I mean, incredible. The music they can't hear anywhere else, right? I mean, you know, and it goes very deep into these genres of whether it be Mixteco music or whether it be Tejano, Conjunto, or it be Mariachi. You know, there's no station like that even in Mexico for Mariachi or for indigenous music in Oaxaca. You know, they have to come here to the U.S. to enjoy it. So anyway, so that's very important for us. So in the pandemic, it makes all of us, whether myself, but also the staff, volunteers, appreciate what we do. I mean, we have people, for example, impromptu, almost daily saying, you know, you folks provide information we can't get anywhere else.
I think it is frequently underestimated when you hear your own culture coming at you through the airwaves and you hear Tejano or Mariachi or any of the musics that you play. The way it just affirms your identity. And in a time like COVID, something like that, it's ineffable, but it, I don't know, it's like a kind hand on your back.
Oh, yes. Even before the pandemic, we've had testimonials by people, particularly elderly, calling in and saying, you know, I wake up to Radio Bilingüe every morning. It makes me feel good. Or we also have people like from the Bay Area who drive into the San Joaquin Valley, and they put Radio Bilingüe on Sundays for their children to listen to and say, folks, this is real Mexican Chicano radio. This is indigenous people radio. And they tell us about how proud they are that they're able to have a platform where the children can be educated about what the real world is for farm workers and for the Latino community that are, you know, working class and working families.
Well, you've also opened up Radio Bilingüe, for example, the Hmong or Filipinos or African Caribbean traditional music. They also have a home there.
That is correct. And we have done that. We had a Filipino show when we first opened up here in Fresno throughout the 80s until the gentleman passed. And then we were the first radio station to offer the Hmong, who have a high concentration here in the San Joaquin Valley, to have their own radio show. And it wasn't somebody else doing their show. We literally trained them just like we trained everybody else to speak for themselves through the medium. So we were the first radio show, Hmong radio, in the Western Hemisphere, Radio Bilingüe. You know, and then African Americans find a friendly platform here and so on. I'm just really, really proud of that. And I think part of it came from being in the labor camp and growing up with African-American children, poor white kids who were often called Okies in school, and like identifying with them and saying, you know, hey, we have a resource here. Why don't we share? And I think that's the attitude we take at Radio Bilingue. And I wish we could do more.
When you look at the work you've all done at Radio Bilingue, what gives you the most happiness, the most satisfaction, do you think?
Wow. There's a lot of things. One of them is the information. Is incredible, the amount of information that we're giving out that is very important. Well, first of all, the basic information, like during the pandemic, you know, where'd you get your testing? You know, what is the the virus? You know, all these basic information that in the mainstream, you know, is well known. But to the working families that is do not speak English, it's very difficult to get to. But also to be able to build that platform where you can have an educated engagement about policy. And to have farm workers talking to the congressman or the local city council person or a school board member or activist, or to have a conversation between Nati Cano, the great mariachero, with people that enjoy his music. You know, same with Flaco Jimenez and all those folk. So you have these, you know, and then you also have, you know, not a Flaco Jimenez, but some of the more local unknown artists, shall we say, you know, so that's what we do. And these festivals we did, you know, with mariachi over spanning over 20 years annually and a decade of Tejano Norteño concerts as well live. And the promotion of this music, highlighting it on 24 of our own 24/7. And then having, you know, 70 other affiliates around the country. It's just incredible to have done that. I think that's, to me, to hear those voices, to feel people feel identified with that, you know, and you can hear it through the testimonials of people calling. It's just an incredible, how would I say, achievement. And I know it's a team effort. You know, there's no way that I could have done it. And frankly, when I was 13 years old, I thought it was a one-man show, but I quickly learned once around the beginning, it's not a one-man show. It really is a team effort. We've been blessed with incredible supportive board, but also incredible generations of volunteers, thousands literally, and then generations of staff that have been so committed and professional and committed to the mission, but also committed to the organization. I feel really, really truly blessed.
Okay, and finally, being named a National Heritage Fellow, what does that mean for you, Ugo?
Well, first of all, I cannot really place myself in that category. It's hard for me to accept that I'm in that way special, you know, because there's just so many wonderful people who are doing incredible work. But I think for me, it's more of an institutional recognition by the National Endowment of the Arts, because I'm an immigrant. To be an immigrant in the U.S. at this time, even recognized, to me, that means a lot. And also, I think it means a lot for community radio, being authentic radio for authentic voices, independent radio, and then also living cultures and the value of immigrants and the value of diversity and respect for others, diverse people woven together by a common goal to make their communities better into one community of diversity, that can thrive and exist and be functional and operate. And that's Radio Bilingue is an example of that. And I really appreciate that Radio Bilingue would be recognized by a national institution like the National Endowment for the Arts.
Well, Ugo, so well deserved for everyone who's worked on Radio Bilingue, which is a gift to the country. So many, many thanks. And thank you for giving me your time.
Thank you.
That was the founder and executive director of Radio Bilingue and the 2020 Bess Lomax Hawes National Heritage Fellow, Ugo Morales. Because of the pandemic, the annual celebration of the new class of National Heritage Fellows will take place virtually this time. Details will be available shortly at arts.gov. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Don't forget to subscribe to Artworks and then leave us a rating on Apple because it helps people to find us. And follow us on Twitter at NEA Arts. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe and thanks for listening.